from the internet and on your computer, obviously. So we also are known as Tufts Educational Radio, and we got a lot of different names for ourselves. But there's that legal name, WMFO Medford. Yay. And we'll do a quick public service announcement here. And it's always a... okay, we'll just do this one because we opened up to it. Why not cover your computer camera? If you have a computer with a webcam and you don't use it, why not cover the camera up with a piece of opaque tape? That means tape you can't see through. In addition to government programs, there's plenty of other malware and viruses that can hijack the computer's camera to spy on you. So if you don't use it, consider covering it up. A message in the public interest from WFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Also, if you do use it, you can cover it up and then uncover it. You know, that's important to know. I got a spam thing. I get a lot of spam stuff, unfortunately, through email. And the program I use, or where I work uses, they catch a lot of that spam, but not all of it, blah, blah, blah. And some of it is focused on the camera. We took tape of you, we took video of you through your camera, blah, blah, blah. Oh, here we go. Here's another one. Public service announcement. Numbers to think about, public service announcement. Some numbers to think about. The United States has less than 5% of the planet's population, but incarcerates, that's a big word for throws into prison, 24% of its prisoners and account, oh, I'm sorry, 24% of its people, I guess, and accounts for 43% of the world's total military spending. Wow. And I think it's increased since then. By the way, I don't know if we have time to get to it, but I have an article here I wanted to talk about where the Democrats, you know, recently disagreed with Trump on war spending, but disagree meant just a few billion dollars less. We want, as the Democratic Party, just a few billion dollars less than what you want, Trumpo, to go to the military. And both figures are obscene by any standards, nationally or internationally. You've seen those pictures, right, of these graphs. I just saw them again on Facebook. They turn up a lot where you got U.S. military spending, one big bar, black bar on, say, the left side of the graph. Then on the right side of the graph, the next 14 countries combined military spending. And that includes countries like China. I mean, all the countries that are the so-called threat to the United States, plus the ones that smaller, plus some smaller ones. All of those countries combined, rich mostly, are still dwarfed, still tiny compared to, in the amount of military spending compared to the United States. And you can combine all of them and not reach the level, or just reach the level of what the United States government is spending on military spending. So, and I'm not trying to make the argument because it's kind of a liberal argument that I think has some validity, but not much, that all you have to do is cut military spending and everything will be fine under capitalism here in terms of social programs, all the money you'd free up for social programs. Yes and no, and I have to emphasize the no part. The yes part is that you would free up a ton of money by just cutting the military spending even a little bit, but it should be cut drastically in the United States. And you do free up billions and billions, more money than you can believe, for all sorts of things that people need it for. You know, social programs that are really necessary. You know, everything from building homes under public ownership to infrastructure to, you know, mass transit to education. I mean, everything you can think of, childcare subsidies, you name it, a lot could be gained from cutting the military budget drastically, or even not so drastically. You'd still get a lot of money freed up. However, it's not that. It's not primarily that. A lot of money, in addition to that, that goes to corporate welfare. A lot of money just doesn't come into the government at all through the tax cuts for the big corporations and the rich that predated Trump a lot, but Trump has jumped on the bandwagon of course, as a representative of the capitalist class. So it's not just that. It's a lot more revenue has to come in. We need taxes on the super rich and on the big corporations, and lower taxes. No tax increase on working people. That is long overdue as an extended, sustained policy in this country. That, coupled with cuts in the military budget, will create a lot of money. Now, still under capitalism, it will still be class war. It will still be difficult to maintain that, to achieve it and to maintain it. And that's an understatement. And the rich will find a way to sabotage it, the big corporations. Back to Stop and Shop workers here in New England. Socialist Alternative has a nice leaflet. I just want to read from it because it summarizes what I was just talking about. Fight corporate greed at Stop and Shop. Stand with Stop and Shop workers. No capped wages. That's that cap at $18.50 I mentioned. No cuts to vacation. Keep time and a half Sunday and holiday pay. Keep the pension system. With leaflets, you have to like keep things short. But here, this, and it does get into vacation in the text. Now that answers one of the questions I had. Workers that have dedicated, I'm quoting from the leaflet from Socialist Alternative. Workers that have dedicated 5+ years to the company are being threatened with the loss of 1 week of their well-deserved 2 weeks of paid vacation. Only 2 weeks of paid vacation. Now my father, the job he ended up with, for all the time I knew him, and until he retired, only had 2 weeks paid vacation. The amount of stress and problems that caused in our family was almost incalculable. I mean, it was just horrible what that would do. When you need to take a day off for something, I don't think he even had the option of using the vacation days individually. I think he had to like call in sick, and there was limits to that. So every day you got to drag yourself into work, whether you're sick or not, whether your kids need this or that. I mean, it was evil to only have 2 weeks paid vacation. My mother had, I think, a week more because she wasn't in the union that I was in, ended up in, the Baker Workers Union, but she got the equivalent of their contracts in order to prevent her and her clerical worker, secretary friends from organizing. So they were just given automatically whatever the factory and drivers, workers and drivers got in the Bakery Workers Union. So at the time. So anyway, this leaflet about Stop and Shop workers goes on to say, as housing costs and overall cost of living skyrockets, it's hard enough to make ends meet and pay the bills, let alone save for retirement. And now this company is trying to take away the pension system for its workers. Stop and Shop employees are joining the thousands of people across the country who are saying enough is enough and standing up to the greed of big corporations and their CEOs. Across the country, teachers have been striking for higher pay and full funding for schools and winning. In every instance, it's taken entire communities standing with them. Members of all 5 United Food and Commercial Workers Union locals, local just means union in a certain area, a certain workplace or workplaces, across Massachusetts have voted overwhelmingly to strike if necessary. United Food and Commercial Workers leadership should stand strong behind this vote and begin seriously preparing for strike action. Working people across Massachusetts must come together and make sure that Stop and Shop pays their workers a fair wage and defend the benefits that all workers deserve. And if they do go on strike, I will go to the picket line. I hope they welcome public support on the picket line or support of other workers. We also have in Social Alternative a petition that we're using around at different events and tabling at places and so on, informational tabling. Stop corporate greed at Stop and Shop. I will not cross the picket line of Stop and Shop workers' strike. No cap wages. Keep the pension system. No cuts to vacation. Keep time and a half on Sundays. And then it says working people across Massachusetts must come together and make sure that Stop and Shop pays their workers a fair wage and defend the benefits that all workers deserve. We stand with Stop and Shop workers. So that's a good petition. I really like that. I promised you also a little bit of explanation of why, as socialists, we're so concerned about the strike of workers and so on. Even in one little place, and Stop and Shop's not little, by the way. Well, socialists for anything improves the lives of working people. Even reforms under capitalism, even temporary reforms, and we can guarantee you, unfortunately, that reforms under capitalism will be temporary. How many people thought pensions were forever? I remember this moment in college. This was something I'll never forget. I was new to college, right? And it was the first parents' visiting day, whatever they call those things. And I was sitting alone at lunch, and some guy's father was there. And I started out going to a college where the majority of people there were majoring in business, right? Big mistake on my part, but what did I know about college? Nothing. So I go there eating my lunch, and I'm listening to this father who worked at Polaroid, the Polaroid Corporation in upstate New York. and was bragging, you know, get in there, you're set for life, you get a pension, you get this and this. Now, you're going to say, some of you will say it's because of technological changes. Nah, it happened fast, not just because of technological changes, because of the general, you know, the general race to the bottom that capitalists do, force workers to do in order to make more profits. So it was like very short time after that, I'm hearing about cuts in Polaroid. And I always thought back to that, you know, this corporation that seemed unassailable. It seemed like, you know, you're set for life. And of course, where I grew up, Schenectady, New York, and around Schenectady, New York, that say, people were saying the same thing about General Electric, you know. Oh, you get in at GE and you're set for life, you know, you got the union, blah, 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 you know. And yeah, there was a union there. There is a union there, and but it's a union that after 1969 kind of stopped fighting. 69 was the watershed moment. It was this big mark where there was a strike, a big strike, and the union needed to win that strike. I think it was considered, you know, a loss or at least a mixed victory. And after that, they lost their stomach to fight, as far as I can see. And the local has shrunk ever since. So anyway, there's a lot of times under capitalism where you'll see people hoping against hope. I don't blame them. Again, it's the way it's a survival mechanism. Say, hey, you get in this company, you're set for life, pension, etc. And then the next thing you know, next moment, the company's clawing away, clawing back the pensions and so on. And a lot of workers blame that on the unions. It's funny. You know, they'll say, when I've been organizing unions in different workplaces, when I've helped to organize unions in different workplaces, people will say things like, X happened, and that's why I don't like the union. And the two things don't follow. So basically what they're doing is they're blaming the union for something that management did. Management cut your pension. The union didn't cut your pension. If you want to have a discussion about, did the union fight hard enough, and could unions be fighting more, I'm on your side immediately. Unions could be doing a lot more, fighting harder, et cetera, but they don't initiate this stuff. They don't, you know, I mean, there are some really sick union leaders that bargain, that they start from a concessionary basis. They'll actually go to management with a concession. I think my unionship does that, unfortunately. It's really horrible. Concessionary, they call it interest-based bargaining, which means they like to look at things from a management point of view. So they'll actually go in with a concession. But most unions, still, they're not going to beg concessions off management. Management comes in, like it's Stop and Shop, and attacks, goes on the attack and tries for concessions. The union tries to hold the line, but you have to go. But really, what that's another problem. Unions can't hold the line. They have to improve. They have to go further. They have to make gains in order to be able to organize, in order to be able to keep what they have, etc. But that's another slight angle on this. But the angle I'm talking about is that, you know, the company does a lot of things that the union ends up getting blamed for, and the only way you can blame the union is if you figure out that the union didn't fight hard enough, then there's some blame there. But the real blame, the most of the blame, and all the blame in a lot of cases, is management initiating the concession or the attack just to make more money on top of the money they're already making. But back to the main theme here, to end the sort of part of the show about Stop and Shop, is why do socialists care about unions? And what are we doing promoting the rights and benefits of these workers? Well, socialism comes from the working class, and socialists started the labor movement in every country you can think of, and including the United States, which a lot of people don't know about. And there's some people in the carpenters union that I know that they go through their apprenticeship training, and the carpenters union still has the guts to admit, to say that the founder of the carpenters union, one of the main leaders of the carpenters union in getting it off the ground, was a socialist, P.J. McGuire. And if every union leadership did education, and they did it, if they did it honestly, they'd be saying so-and-so is a socialist, or these people were socialists, and they started this union. You rarely get that, but it did exist before. And the reality is that the reason socialists started unions, and often socialists now are involved with unions, leading unions in some cases, is that they are... they see the role that unions can play in fighting for working people in the workplace and in the communities. I mean, it's something that works, you know? I mean, if you get a decent raise your whole life changes under capitalism. That's what it comes down to. I mean, it comes down to money. Every worker learns that one way or the other, right? But also benefits are money, and time off, you know, can keep you, is kind of money. You know, I mean, when I say money, I don't mean to reduce it to dollar bills or whatever, although that is a one way to look at it. Can't argue too much with that. More dollar bills in your pocket, the better life you're going to have under capitalism. Although capitalism does some things to us through alienating, separating us from our work, the results of our work, from each other, from our families, and so on, that creates a cycle of violence and alienation and so on, that no matter how much money you have, you can't escape. That's a whole nother topic. But you're better able to survive and escape the worst of capitalism the stronger you are as a worker and as a community of workers by making a livable wage, a decent wage, and having more choices and so on. And so socialists are for anything that improves the living standards of working people, right? That's the vast majority. When we say working people, we mean people that want to work that can't. We mean retired people, working class, them. In the widest definition you can think of, stopping only at those that are rich enough to not work, those that are rich and don't work, those that exploit other people's labor because they're rich enough to do so. Also, the history of socialism is unions playing an important role in socialist movements and socialist revolutions. A role that, in terms of starting socialist political parties or labor parties that had socialist policies and so on, in terms of unions filled with socialists, or I don't mean every last worker, but a lot of socialists, unions that affiliated with socialism that fought for better housing, better sanitary conditions in communities and all sorts of stuff in the history of socialism and the working class living standards improving for a time under capitalism at certain times, and then trying to defend, like now, capitalists from throwing us all into the dirt and stepping on us on top of that. Also, that as part of the revolutionary movement, unions have played a role, not in and of themselves as revolutionary parties or organizations, but played a role as part of those or supporting those. So, for example, the first Russian Revolution in February 1917, the first revolution in 1917 in Russia was triggered by a massive strike of unionized textile workers, women textile workers, actually, in Russia. Socialists also care about unions on the level of, if you're in a union that's in struggle, you're probably going to see you're probably going to have a slightly, not everybody, but some workers will have a heightened class consciousness. The way capitalism works will be revealed. You go on strike, and the minute you go on strike, the company puts a phone call in and there's cops in your face. How's that work? I thought cops were supposed to be out catching criminals. I'm not a criminal for going on strike. I'm just trying to control my own labor power. I'm not a slave. I don't have to work. I can go on strike, can I? Oh, well, wait a minute. That's illegal? Well, you know, sometimes it is, by the way. Sometimes they declare it illegal or it's ruled illegal. And you're like, wait a minute. No. You see the role of the state. You see the state controlled by the capitalists. You see the Democrats stab you in the back. Many, many big strikes have happened where, in the United States, where workers very quickly scramble to run candidates, usually as independents, and as union members, to counteract the vicious repression of the local government run by Democrats or Republicans against the workers on strike. And that's, so you have these moments when workers are in struggle through unions, through strikes or occupations, which are less known now but used to be a big weapon in the labor movement, when the state is being used at the service of the capitalists. That tells you a lot. Wait a minute, I thought the government was for the people. That's what they taught me, and here it is, only for the rich people, only for the big corporations. So wait a minute, who can I count on? My fellow workers, working people. I'm a worker. I'm not a middle class person. I'm actually a worker, you know, that sort of thing. I mean, it's a moment. It's a teachable moment. And as a result of that, laying bare of the reality of capitalism for unionized workers, workers organized together at the point of production and distribution, That's a very powerful thing, an extremely powerful thing. Increased class consciousness of those workers is the death of capitalism, ultimately. Because some of those workers, at least, will, especially leaders, but others too, will join socialist groups, socialist parties, like Eugene Debs, right? Eugene Debs, railroad worker as a teenager, becomes known as a leader in the union, becomes a leader in the union, supports the Democrats like everybody else. Then they go on strike, a massive nationwide railroad strike. The government clamps down hard to stop the strike on behalf of the bosses, their paymasters. And they and Debs gets thrown in prison. He's visited by socialists. They say, here's why this went down this way. Historically, this is the way it works under capitalism, etc. Debs becomes a socialist, never again supports the Democratic Party or the Republicans. And he becomes a great socialist leader, Eugene Debs. Look him up, D-E-B-S, Eugene Debs, in the United States. Did not support World War One. Got thrown in prison, ran for president from prison, got millions, hundreds of thousands of votes for president from a prison cell in a federal prison. And Debs was a great socialist leader. But the process he went through, millions of other workers went through in the United States at different times historically and are going through now, actually. Well, at least I don't want to say millions and millions, but let's say safely, you could say millions or hundreds of thousands, very, very safely, are going through the same process of they go into struggle. They see the system is rigged for the wealthy, obviously. It's their system. And some of them draw the conclusions of the need to become socialists. So socialists are interested in meeting those workers because they know that through the struggle in these unions, which were started by socialists, by the way, and the best fighters in unions, the best leaders, the best supporters are socialists. All this kind of works together. So many workers from unions, hopefully, at a time of upsurge in the socialist movement, will join socialist organizations, socialist parties, and so on. So that's a quick explanation of that, of why socialists support unions and so on. I want to get into now this idea of middle class. And I'm going to indulge the phrase after I've been attacking it at a couple points during the show. We're working class. We're not middle class. Middle class shoves people into a category that make less than livable wages into people that in certain parts of the country make a wage that they could, after a few years at least, create enough money to not work in some way. But this is an author I've quoted before, Alyssa Quart, Q-U-A-R-T. She wrote a book I've quoted from. Can't remember the title off the top of my head. So this is a recent article she wrote, how middle class once meant stability and now means fragility. And there's just some, I thought of this article. I found this article, thought I'd check it out for the show, but also it kind of fits in what we're talking about, because it's the weakness in the labor movement and in unions, and she often talks about that. I don't know if she does in this article. That is a result of working class people, or what she would call middle class, or actually she's actually talking about higher paid workers in a lot of cases, all of a sudden living paycheck to paycheck, having very precarious futures and so on. And that's where this one starts off. The middle class, quote unquote, used to be the bedrock of American institutions. Now they're coping with an uncertain future. I feel that being middle class, this is a quote, I feel that being middle class is not what it once was, and that we are all running in place as fast as we can to stay the same. To quote Alice in Wonderland's Red Queen, end quote. That's Brenda Madison, an art director and graphic designer in Laguna Beach, Orange County, California, told the author Alyssa Quart. Quote, never did I think I would worry about Social Security and Medicare, that they may not be available in my future, or that a medical injury or unexpected repair, meaning like a car repair, would bankrupt us, end quote. Well, that's certainly true. I've got a car sitting in my driveway, bought used. It was a lemon from day one. Big mistake to buy it, but can't see the future. And just it got to the point where we couldn't afford the repairs on it anymore. So it sits in a driveway now, and we're still paying the loan on it. That galls me, man. It just drives me crazy. because we can't afford the repair. The repairs would start at 800 something and then go up to 1,000 and possibly more. So this person that Alyssa Court is quoting, what's her name again? Brenda Madison says, Alyssa Court says, she and her husband, now in their middle years, quote, are not sure we'll be able to retire in our own home. Now, that's what these, like, double mortgages and all that stuff that you hear about, reverse mortgages and all that. These are people that the last asset they have is a house, usually still paying for it, and they can negotiate a new loan that basically means they lose the house when they die, or when one of them dies, or when something happens that's in the contract, and their kids don't then get that house, etc. Patricia Moore, here's another person, Alyssa Court, the author's focus on, is a single mother of three who lives in a two-bedroom apartment in L.A., Los Angeles, and a licensed vocational nurse. So you think nurse must make some decent money, working in hospice, and then she's about to take the licensing exam to become a registered nurse. Due to a shortage of space, she sleeps on the couch and, quote, is still struggling to make ends meet, end quote, because her rent is $1,598 a month. Her pay is about $3,200, and her student loan payback is $375 a month. So Moore recently had to resort to a GoFundMe campaign so she could stay home with her daughter during a month-long health crisis, and at times had to donate plasma. She said she is unable to provide, quote, the extras for her kids. So then Moore, this woman began to enter her youngest son in focus groups in office buildings or hotels in neighborhoods like Beverly Hills. Now, I had this thing with focus groups, right? So I work at Harvard, a clerical position, and a library position, never paid enough. And so throughout my years there, I often try to work a second job. I have worked second jobs, sometimes third jobs. And I mentioned that Barnes & Noble thing, that was a second job. So I try these focus groups things, and for a while, that seemed to be working. Like every few months, I could get in a focus group, make a little extra cash, and I love that. Now, I'm sort of aging out of them or something. I'm aging and technologically out of them. You have to have a smartphone, which I don't have. I'm one of the last people without a smartphone because I can't afford it. So I don't have a smartphone. A lot of these groups now, you go through a survey first to see if you're eligible. They didn't used to have that either. You go through an online survey, these focus groups, at least the company I deal with, and you can get knocked out. You don't know exactly what they want on the questions, and you get knocked out easily. So I get knocked out of every survey I try to online. You can't even get into the office. They used to interview you over the phone. They don't even do that anymore. You just sometimes they do it in addition to the online interview, so to speak. So I get knocked out because I'm too old. I get knocked out because I don't have a smartphone. I get knocked out because I answer the questions wrong. You try to anticipate how they want you to answer and you don't get it. So I don't get that anymore, you know? And then even the last time I did it, which was maybe 2 years ago, they weren't even giving out cash anymore. They give out a gift card. So go buy some groceries with that. And I remember some guy who was used to, you could tell he was like me, you know, he was trying to do the thing of this is a way to supplement his income, these focus group things. And he was, you know, trying to, this was a gig for him, you know. He's like, gift card? I can't pay my bills with a gift card. And he was absolutely right. He was absolutely right. So here's a person telling her kid, she doesn't say how old, to go do these things, these focus groups. And whenever it works and he gets the money, that's when she says, okay, go buy yourself a toy or something. Other than that, no toys, no extras. So then quoting the article again, the extreme cost of living has forced some California families to take unusual steps like the one she just quoted. As the Department of Housing and Urban Development recently reported, a family of four in the San Francisco metropolitan area making $117,400 a year qualifies as, quote, low income. So you could be in a family, and your combined income can equal almost $120,000 a year, $117,400 in this case, and you can be defined as low income because the cost of living is so high, the cost of housing, transportation, etc. in the San Francisco area, for example. There were Americans for whom, I'm quoting the article again, the meaning of middle class had altered from something stable to implied economic fragility. Again, that's why we shouldn't be using the word middle class. One reason, but anyway, the phrase. Their burdens were the price of health and child care, educational debt, a housing market gone berserk. They wanted job security, pensions and social security, and unions. But these things seemed like a fantasy out of a mid-century American novel, like The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit. The middle class's long historical association with the status quo, strongly identifying with institutions or corporations, rejecting rest of discontent, has made their new wobbliness all the more startling to them. It's funny she used the word wobbliness. She doesn't mean the union here, but it's maybe a double meaning. You know, their wobbliness in terms of precarity of their situation, sliding into poverty, missing a paycheck, boom, you could be homeless or something. Wobbly, the union movement from the turn of the century, the Wobblies, the IWW. Anyway, but when did that vulnerability start? And toward the end of the past century into this new one, there was a rise in what author Barbara Ehrenreich had called a, quote, fear of falling, end quote, an anxiety among the professional managerial class about downward mobility. So here we are talking about the higher paid section of workers, people that probably don't consider themselves working class. Not the first thought that comes into their mind, obviously. They might be bossing other people around, and yet they too are falling into this paycheck to paycheck living. And you have to understand that about the U.S. now. I think of fear of falling as the opposite side of the coin of American individualism and its historic promise of social and economic progress. Since the 80s, most members of the middle class have gone, quote, from a kind of security to being reduced to the kind of economic unstable state that working class Americans have had to experience forever. So here, this is the problem with the article, but whatever. The middle class is posited as above working class. And that, I would say, is a more accurate thing, but I'm seeing that in the context of this article, it means both types of people that actually work. You know what I mean? Like, if you want a true definition of middle class, it would be small owner, small proprietor, somebody that owns a business. That would be middle class, basically, the real middle class. Then everybody else would be working class. And the number of people that actually own businesses is quite small compared to what we're taught. The officer academic job starts to resemble the precarious work life. So those are, see, again, all of a sudden they're being lumped into middle class. Those are working class jobs. I don't want to keep going over the term, but it is important. And we should be using working class instead of middle class. But like I said, for this article, I'm going to indulge and go with the middle class term, which really means working class. This new fragility is one thing to explain the 2016 election of Trump. Trump voters were sometimes mistaken for all hillbilly, elegiac, or Rust Belt proletariat. In truth, an estimated 38% of white people with bachelor degrees voted for Trump, closer to the office worker elegy. Indeed, as much as Trump's messaging has been jingoistic or racist, he has also been addressing middle class anxiety when he continually repeated the system is rigged. Now, there's a lot of different statistics about that, finding that upper middle class people, in terms of the real sense of middle class, voted for Trump more than working class people did. But what they're getting at is that precariousness can lead, especially in a system, and I'll add this myself, where we're taught the two-party system is all there is politically, and if you're getting screwed over by the Democrats in your area or your state or whatever, then or you hear a right-wing demagogue populist like Trump, something catches your ear, and then you end up voting for that, which is a huge mistake, but you end up voting for that. It's also a mistake to vote Democrat, but you're taught to vote the other party out. What, you know, that old phrase about vote out the one that you don't, punish the party in power if you don't like their policies and all that, as if that's really punishing them. You know, you can easily move from Democratic to Republican Party, even as a politician, not to mention a voter. So this is a pretty good article, and it feeds into her book, that Alyssa Quartz book, that goes into this in much more detail that we've read from a little bit on the show. And then that segues into this thing I want to talk about, which you probably heard a lot about from the media, maybe from people at work, that when this college admissions scandal broke in the United States here, rich people buying people to take their standardized tests, the SATs or the ACT test, rich people buying a place on athletic teams in order to get into schools that prioritize athletics, athletes for scholarship and getting in, athletes for getting in to the, because they need the athletes, they think. the other just bribing, you know, coaches to do that, et cetera. There was different aspects to the way they got in to schools that they hadn't, like, just, you know, had the grades or the test scores for. But, of course, the whole system is like that. Capitalism is always about that kind of corruption. And there's the acceptable corruption of big donations to a university equaling acceptance of the children of the donors. There's legacy, as they call them, at Harvard. I don't know how widespread that term is. Students whose parents or grandparents or whatever, they have some sort of, like, genetic or generational or family that went to Harvard, and therefore they're going to get cut a break to go to Harvard as well. I think that happens in other schools as well. But it's just also the money, right? If you're part of the capitalist class or part of the super rich or the rich in the capitalist system, you can get into the better schools because you can buy the properties in the high property taxed areas, and the property taxes primarily funding schools. You can buy your way into private schools. You can get private tutors. You can pay the costs of applying to colleges and applying to many colleges and getting into one. I mean, it goes on and on. The level of money giving you a lot of money, giving you an advantage in school, whether it's even daycare, right? Oh, so-and-so, a rich person's kid goes to this really, really nice daycare place where they start teaching you things at a young age, and poor person's kid goes to maybe, if they're lucky, grandma, but probably sits in front of the TV all day, or if they're unlucky, a stranger's house and sits in front of the TV all day in some sort of cobbled together so-called daycare. So anyway, this is an article written by something called the Independent Media Institute. Was put into Common Dreams' website, commondreams.org, March 14th, 2019. And, quote, "The children of working stiffs learned a brutal lesson this week as federal prosecutors criminally charged rich people, some rich people, I'll add, with buying admission to elite universities for their less-than-stellar children. The lesson is that no matter how hard you work, no matter how smart or talented you are, a dumb, lazy, rich kid is going to beat you." Now, again, I think the point of this article is that this lesson already existed. But anyway, it's crucial that everyone who is not a wealthy movie star, hedge fund executive, or corporate CEO, that is 99% of all Americans, sees this college admissions scandal for what it really is, a microcosm of the larger corrupt system that works against working people, squashing their chances for advancement. Sounds like something I would say. This system is the reason that rich people and corporations got massive tax breaks last year, while the 99% got paltry ones. Or actually, some, I'll add, pay more in taxes last year. It is the reason the federal minimum wage and the overtime threshold are stuck at poverty levels. It is the reason labor unions have dwindled over the past four decades. The system is the reason we cannot have nice things. Despite all of that land of equal opportunity crap, the rich ensure that only they can have nice things, starting with what they can buy legally or illegally for their children, and rising through that, what they can buy legally and illegally from politicians who make the rules that withdraw money from the pockets of the working people and deposit it in the bulging bank accounts of the fabulously rich. By the way, think of the Stop and Shop strike about Stop and Shop situation and that too, in that context as well. Continuing to quote this article, when the mastermind of the elite university admission scheme, William Singer, pleaded guilty this week, he exposed the launching pad available to the well-heeled to guarantee that their children will be well-heeled, even after the wealthy pay for their heirs, HEIRS, to attend prohibitively expensive private preparatory academies, their grades, test scores, and extracurricular activities may not add up to enough to gain them entrance to Ivy League universities, from which a degree virtually assures an overpaid position on Wall Street, and with it, another generation of wealth accumulation. Interesting point. I saw a statistic. It should be double-checked, because it's a little old now. It might be even more than that. But a certain high percentage, I think it was 38 or maybe even 48% of Harvard grads are now going into the financial services or financial, whatever you want to call it, world of Wall Street, hedge funds, and all that kind of stuff. So what they're saying here is really happening a lot. You know, you think of that going to an Ivy League school as, oh, wow, you know, I'm going to have all these resources to study wonderful things. And you're up using all that for making more money for the capitalists and in the process getting a high salary until you can become the next round of capitalist if you don't enter that realm immediately. So anyway, let's... Oh, yeah. Singer admitted he developed a workaround for the wealthy. The indictment revealed that through Singer, parents handed between $15,000 to $75,000 to college entrance exam administrators to fabricate top-notch test scores for low-achieving offspring. The lower the amount, $15,000, say, paid by the rich to pad SAT and ACT scores is a good example. It's a figure of trifling import to a one percenter. It's however the entire year's earnings, $15,000, of a parent working full-time at the federal $7.25 minimum wage. That parent may have a child who received a perfect SAT score without cheating, who has earned straight A's even in advanced placement classes, who excelled in soccer and served as class president. But that child of a minimum wage worker won't get into Harvard because the rich kid took his place with falsified test scores and faked athletic achievements. And the rich kid and his parents have the means to ensure that members of the next generation of the family that have the same opportunity to cheat their way to the top will have the same opportunity to cheat their way to the top and remain there. They have the money to buy just the right politicians, something that the perverse Citizens United and McCutcheon decisions by the Supreme Court facilitated. The right-wing court ruled that rich people and corporations could give you unlimited money to elect politicians of their choice. Politicians chosen by the wealthy won't support unions, minimum wage increases, or higher overtime thresholds. They won't cultivate opportunity for the 98%. They won't require corporations to treat workers as humans with dignity. Politicians chosen by the rich have passed legislation state after state intended to bankrupt labor unions, the very organizations that were so crucial to creating the middle class in America. Under the legislation, labor unions are forbidden to collect small fees from people who choose not to join, even though the union has to represent them. The weakened unions, they're required by federal regulations to provide services for all those who labor in a unionized workplace, whether they join the union or not. So what these politicians are doing is requiring unions to represent non-members for free. It's devastated labor organizations in some places, including Wisconsin. The result is lower wages and worse benefits for all workers because higher union bargain pay pulls up incomes in an entire region. The logic here is simple. Less for workers, more for fat cats. And of course, politicians chosen by rich people will not raise the minimum wage. The federal minimum wage has remained at a painfully low $7.25 for a decade. That is a crime. I'm just not quoting here, but I mean, that is an incredible crime. Now, that's a poverty wage, according to the article says. It means a person who works full-time cannot support themselves and certainly can't provide for a family. In Washington, D.C. and other cities, other expensive cities, some full-time minimum wage workers are homeless. The substandard minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, pulls down all wages. Similarly, politicians chosen by the rich will not significantly increase the $23,660 overtime threshold under which all workers must be paid time and a half for hours beyond 40 in a week. Former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, now chair of the Democratic National Committee, proposed in 2016 doubling the threshold to $47,476, which would have enabled an additional 4 million workers to qualify for overtime pay. Often these are workers given fancy titles like assistant night manager, but only paid $24,000 a year or so. Their fast food restaurant boss can require them to work 50, 60, even 70 hours a week with no extra pay at all. For these families, the overtime pay would be extremely meaningful in ways that are incomprehensible to families that can dish out $15,000 to $75,000 to cheat on the SAT test. Fast food corporations, including CKE owner of Carl's Jr. and Hardee's, opposed the proposed overtime threshold increase. The CEO of CKE at the time, Andrew F. Puzder, worth $45 million, wrote an essay condemning the increase and explaining how millions of low-paid workers with fancy titles should love to work extra time without extra pay because it gave them the opportunity to work their way up to the top like one guy at CKE did one time. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, a lobby group for rich corporations, filed suit against the increase and scuttled it. So now the overtime threshold has not increased for 15 years. A new labor secretary last week offered a much stingier increase. Alexander Acosta proposed a $35,308 as the threshold. Only about 1 million additional workers would benefit if the number were that low. And instead of automatic increases every 3 years, the Labor Department would consider whether to raise it only every 4 years, no guarantees. And so then the article gives a few more statistics, basically ends by saying, it's no shock. I'm sorry, wait, there's a point I wanted to read here. There's no reason to take heart from the fact that the prosecutors stymied one specific college admission scam. It is illegal to pay an SAT proctor to alter test scores. It is not illegal, though. To buy a science lab for Harvard or a humanities building for Yale with the hope that the family name probably engraved on the edifice will sway admission officers when they see the name, the same name, on an application. Excuse me. It's no shock college admissions are rigged for the rich. The whole economic system is rigged by the rich. Until working people change that, their opportunities and those of their children will continue to diminish. This article was produced by the Independent Media Institute. So, I thought that was good, fit into the general theme. In terms of what we have time for, only 15 minutes left in the show, we don't have time for my ambitious plans, as usual, for the show. But I will end with that point I mentioned about the Democrats and Trump on the, how basically they agree on a Pentagon increase, an increase in war funding, but they quibble on the details. So Trump requested a military budget. That's another record breaker. And the Democrats counter with their own increase. So Trump's was $750 billion proposed, more than $36 billion. $36 billion more than last year's record $714 billion military budget in the United States. An increase that experts say, I'm quoting here from Common Dreams, March 20, 2019. Let's see who wrote this. They don't give a name, so it might be that same independent media network. Ah, nobody. Okay, Common Dreams does not tell us who wrote this article. Okay, that's all right. This you can find this stuff in other places. They're quoting here Matt Taibbi, T-A-I-B-B-I, who wrote in Rolling Stone some of this stuff. Experts, blah, blah, say is aimed at China and Russia, this huge budget. Democrats have signaled that that increase is a non-starter, but their counteroffer of $733 billion isn't exactly a difference in more than degrees. So, in other words, Trump says, let's put $750 billion, a record amount, because the last record was last year, $714 billion. Let's put $750 billion in. Democrats' counter is another record amount, $733 billion. You know, let's do the math. What is that, $17 billion difference? 33, 43 is 10, $17 billion difference. That's Trump change at that level. So the Democrats want to lower Trump's number, said Taibbi. But still give the Pentagon a huge raise. I added the word huge because Taibbi is pulling his punches for some reason. The budget increase marks a new direction on a number of levels. Trump is breaking with tradition on federal spending by increasing the military budget while slashing social services. What? That's not... That is tradition. Anyway, maybe the rest of this article sucks, but let me just see. Let me just... I read it before the show, but I didn't... That sentence really bothers me because it's not true. Pentagon spending proposes the new military budget will double the discretionary war fund the military uses while cutting the standing Pentagon budget by $71 billion. So it's going from one thing to it's like a little shell game all within war spending. Let's see. Well, so Taibbi or somebody said that this is appalling because the House is now controlled by Democrats. And they're still going to end up with, and their proposal of $733 billion would give the military most of what it wants in 2020. And like I mentioned, would still be a record level of spending over the $714 billion in 2018 record. The House Budget Committee, the number they've talked about for defense is $733 billion. It's not an insubstantial number. So then there's, let's see, progressives will learn to love at least tolerable high levels of military spending, precisely because it tends to advance a key progressive goal. This part I'm not sure about either. Improving the economic fortunes of the middle class. Yeah, well, critics reject that argument. That's all under the military Keynesianism is back, somebody tweeted, someone named journalist Ben Norton. And these progressives want you to know that killing people in the global south is good for the economy. Democrats must not allow one penny over the budget cap. Anyway, so it's jumping from one thing to another at the end of the article, but basically it's saying, well, some liberals, and of course that's true, like these large, they don't go after these large military budgets, and some even go further and, you know, get into this military Keynesian. It was actually a thing that Reagan did. The Reagan administration perfected in some ways. They and the article activist group Code Pink suggested the money can be better spent elsewhere in a call to action. Spend our tax dollars on healthcare, food, housing, and money for a new Green Deal. The group tweeted, no kidding, that makes a lot of sense. But then a lot of them are probably going to go vote Democrat, unfortunately. So this is the problem, right? Republicans come up with a record level of spending for war, and the Democrats also come up with a record level of spending for war, a difference of only $17 billion. And that tells you a lot about the 2020 elections in that one little statistic. So we're fortunately running out of time here. We're going to go out with some music today rather than going to the very last minute of the show. And we want to thank everyone for listening. We want to remind our listeners, please, and everyone out there, brothers and sisters, sisters and brothers, comrades, friends, pressure the hell out of the Stop and Shop management. You know, find ways to get in touch with them. Tell them to settle, give them everything the union wants and then some. Because the workers deserve it. We all deserve it as working people. And find out ways to, you know, you can go to Massachusetts Jobs with Justice if you're from Massachusetts, or if you're not, you could sign this online petition. I'm not saying that's a big deal, but it's something. If you hear of a rally, go to a rally. If they go on strike, don't cross the picket line. Don't stop at Stop and Shop. Tell others not to shop at Stop and Shop. And see if you can go to the picket line and help. Just show up and say, can I speak to the shop steward or somebody? I just want to show my support. Mind if I walk around the picket with you and so on? Make a sign or whatever. Bring them some water or whatever. You know, some donuts. There's this thing about bringing donuts, but I mean, donuts are killers, so I'm not going to say bring donuts to the picket lines. But anyway, you get the picture. It's time to win back the things that we've been losing through strengthening our unions, through strengthening the socialist movement. And we hope that anyone listening to this show will consider getting in touch. A lot of places to go, but you can start with socialistalternative.org. Start with a Facebook page, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook, and get involved with the socialist movement and fight for a better life for all working people internationally. Thanks for listening today.
children go.
Recently read when your television wants you dead. Lift your covers and meet me at the edge of your bed. How are the children in your head? How are the children? Are they fed? Did it